treasured how Tutankhamun shaped a century. When it was found in 1922, the 3,300-year-old tomb of Tutankhamun sent shockwaves around the world, turning the boy king into a household name overnight and kickstarting an international media obsession that continues to this day. From pop culture and politics to tourism and heritage, from the Jazz Age to climate crisis, it's impossible to imagine the 20th century without this discovery of Tutankhamun, but a lot of the story remains unknown and untouched. For the first time, Christina Riggs weaves compelling historical stories with lives touched by their encounter. The book is called Treasure, How Tutankhamun Shaped a Century. It's by Christina Riggs. I'm delighted to welcome onto the show on the line Christina herself. Christina, good morning to you.
Good morning to you and buenos dias, Spain.
Well, as they say in certain parts of the country, yes. Very good. Whereabouts are you today, by the way?
I'm in County Durham and we do have sunshine this morning, which is lovely.
Well, you'll be, well, I'm not going to say into the weather report, but it's blowing a hoolie out there at the moment from my studio window, so you'll be happy to know that as well. Somewhere where it's probably not blowing a hoolie, but the weather is beautiful, is Egypt. And we tend to, you know, here we go, 100 years ago, basically, we tend to not regard or not think about what a seismic shock the discovery of the boy king's tomb was.
That's right. It was completely unexpected. Nothing like that really had been found before. And it happened in November 1922. So we're coming up to the 100-year anniversary. You're going to hear a lot about Tutankhamun over the next year. But I think you're going to hear only part of the story. And what I wanted to do in Treasured is tell it in a different way and show the kind of long course, the whole century of what, just all the kind of after effects and how many people's lives it changed in different ways. And I think also thinking of Egypt today and where it is, I think, beautiful and sunny, Charles and Camilla are out there at the moment at Luxor,
right,
in the south of the country, which is the main kind of, you know, tourist site where you go to visit the Valley of the Kings and to see the tomb of Tutankhamun. So maybe they'll be doing that.
Well, maybe they'll be doing that indeed. What was the atmosphere like then? Was it a time, I mean, you know, Indiana Jones movies aside, because everybody's going to say that to you, aren't they? Let's face it, it's the curse. The other curse of Tutankhamun is that you have to mention Indy at least once during the interview. But, I mean, it was a time of exploration, Dreadwood, colonialism, and you know, Western nations were going out there into Egypt, into quote unquote the Dark Continent, which I think I can get away with saying these days, and adventuring. So, was there a fashion, a trend in the Jazz Age or just before the Jazz Age to go and discover all things Egyptian?
I think we do have to understand the historical context to this, and it is about colonialism and empire. It is about Europeans going around to different places around the world, including the Middle East and North Africa, to exploit, control resources in those areas. Britain had invaded Egypt in 1882 to protect its investments in the Suez Canal. So the kind of excavations that were happening in Egypt had been going on, you know, since that time. And Howard Carter, the guy who discovers the tomb of Tutankhamun, the kind of Indiana Jones figure, he's just a simple boy from Norfolk, really. But at the age of 17, 18, he goes out and he winds up spending most of the rest of his life in Egypt. So he could make a career there as a kind of, you know, modest, you know, middle class kid from the UK because of the British presence there, because Britain controlled Egypt. Now, when we get to 1922, Giles, there's a lot happening. And Howard's a bit tone deaf about this because Britain has just agreed, after years and years and years of anti-colonial liberation politics in Egypt, right? And after the First World War. So Egypt finally gets its kind of independence from Britain. And this is a huge find of huge importance to Egyptians. And that's part of the story that we haven't understood.
When they stumbled across, I mean, were there because I know very little about this. I mean, I was just saying to on the breakfast show this morning, I'm a child of the 70s, and I remember there was a tremendous enthusiasm because there was it must have been a travelling Tutankhamun exhibition that came to London, and the shockwaves it sent around the UK. Everybody wanted to see it. It was very sort of early 70s, and people were saying, well, look, the styles are almost, and everybody was wearing the same sort of eyeliner, and even, well, not myself, I would be about four at the time, but, you know, it had that cultural effect. But were they looking for Tutankhamun? Did they know it was there, or was it literally a surprise? And B, were they prepared for the scale and the uniqueness of what they found there?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So in 1922, Howard Carter's been, like I said, he's been living out in Egypt. He knows the Valley of the Kings, this area where the pharaohs of that dynasty, the 18th dynasty, are buried. He knows it like the back of his hand. And so they're working to kind of clear it. He's working with his experienced Egyptian archaeologist to do that work. And everybody knows that Tutankhamun is this kind of minor king. They really just know his name. They don't know anything about him. And he's one of the people whose tombs haven't been identified. So he's a possibility, but nobody expected to find it intact as it was, to find just, it was unique. You know, they hadn't seen the gold, the sculpture, the fact that everything is where the priests, when the burial was done, everything is left. So we see the remains of the rituals that were done, like to wrap everything in linen and the different offerings that were made. It's stunning.
I mean,
it's absolutely stunning.
Was it literally then just like walking in sort of a month or 5 minutes after the ceremonies had taken place? And what ceremonies did take place? Because obviously, if you've got sort of basic knowledge of Egypt, you'll think, oh, well, you know, king dies, everybody gets slaughtered and put in the tomb with him. So just dispel a few myths and misconceptions.
So the practice of mummification and burial, that especially for somebody like Tutankhamun, it's about emphasizing his divinity. This is not a human like us, right? And so it's helping to complete that process of turning him into a divine being and creating a space that's all tucked away. Everything's wrapped, everything's sealed. There's little like mud stamp seals on every single thing, and layers of shrines and closures. Nobody is supposed to go into a tomb, right? And the myth of this kind of curse that was already around, of the mummies, was a feature in French and British, you know, stories, like scary stories and novels, already in the 19th century, because it's a kind of anxiety. We know that we're doing the wrong thing. We're disturbing a burial. We're undoing everything the ancient Egyptians had done for Tutankhamun. And so there's no curse. I'm sorry to disappoint you.
Oh.
But it's telling that we think that there's a curse, because I think that's our consciences tweaking.
It's an interesting point, and I hadn't thought about that before, Christina. But yeah, perhaps our thoughts of the mummy come because this is a sacred ground. We're desecrating a tomb. I mean, if an Egyptian explorer had come and, you know, and just suddenly decided to, you know, start tearing into Westminster Abbey, we'd probably have, I don't know, Knights Templar myths going on. But, you know, so this, the whole mummy myth is in fact a reaction to perhaps us desecrating a holy Egyptian site.
It is, yeah. I'm afraid there is this kind of anxiety, and words that to describe it, like science, and you know, there's a rationalization, of course, and it is fascinating. Archaeology can't do what it does if it doesn't destroy these things or undo them. Mm. Let's put it that way. It's not about destruction, but it's about undoing them. And I talk about that in the book. I trained as an archaeologist. You know, I got into, you know, as a little girl, got into Tutankhamun. I had this inspiring teacher in America who'd been to see one of the touring Tutankhamun shows. And so I wanted to be an Egyptologist, and I wanted to go and excavate and do things. But when you get to university and you study it, it's actually the first thing you're taught. Archaeology is destruction. We undo structures to get at something about the past. And in the book, I really want people to reflect on the bigger questions that raises, and on the way that political power, cultural diplomacy, and the history of racism come into the find as well as we look through the whole century.
Because nothing exists in a vacuum. It would be great to say Tutankhamun exists in a vacuum, but this is the 20th century. We've had the end of the First World War. A lot of people are examining, a lot of people are recovering from the horrendous effects of this war. A lot of nations are just trying to discover a lot of what their identities are. And a lot of, as you said before, it is that, you know, the colonial powers, be it in Germany, Belgium, the UK, are on the wane. And it's also a jazz age. It's, you know, the bright young things, the flappers are out, money's going up, stock market's soaring. And a young boy king sort of fits into that narrative. I mean, we'll talk about the geopolitics in a minute, but fashion-wise, correct me if I'm wrong, but the jazz age kind of must have loved the Tutankhamun and the style.
Absolutely. It's perfect. You couldn't have asked, you know, from central casting, give us something that looks like it's predicting Art Deco and all these 1920s, the Tutankhamun rag that they dance, the changes in fashion that are happening, the changes in hairstyles and furniture. So you could buy Egyptian style jewelry and shoes and dresses. Huntley and Palmer's, the British biscuit company, they make these fantastic biscuit tins that look like, you know, look like the little, like in a little Egyptian jar. So it's absolutely perfect. And it really is. Also, because of the First World War, you know, telecommunications, like telegraph lines and all the means of communicating had improved, right? And so that's the birth of the media. The BBC starts broadcasting in 1922 as well. So, and the newspapers and magazine industry is starting to boom. And so the story of Tutankhamun and the photographs that are taken, really stunning photographs, those can be printed and sent around the world. So it's truly a global media event.
And so tell me, why do we have this enduring? Because I said before, you know, I remember, you know, the Tutankhamun coming to London, or the exhibition coming to London in the 70s. So why is there this enduring fascination? It's not just about the curse. You know, it's not just about, you know, Brandon, it's not just The Mummy Returns, is it?
Yeah.
Exactly, Bob Armett. But no, I mean, so why do you think it's because it was such a seismic event, and it gave us a glimpse into the world of sort of our half-remembered or imagined sort of fantasies about what the ancient world was about, and a little bit of mysticism in a world that is becoming increasingly demystified?
I think those are all good points. It is super important. It is media saturation, and it's important for Egyptian and Egypt as a new country asserting its new independence. So it's important for them. It speaks to all these existing Western ideas. But in fact, what I do in the book, one reason I wanted to tell the whole story, is it falls out of fashion at some point. 1930s, 1940s, the world has other things on its mind as it plunges into a new world war. We come out the other side, and in the 1950s, Egypt finally does become independent. Yeah, the 1952 revolution, the 1956 Suez crisis, and the decision to build the Aswan High Dam in the south of the country to generate hydroelectric power to really modernize and put Egypt on an equal footing with other countries in the world. That's where the idea emerges that, oh, you know, these Tutankhamun objects, of which there are thousands, right? What if we sent those on a kind of goodwill tour? So Tutankhamun, this personage, historically, we still don't know very much about him. So we can project what we like onto him, right? And these beautiful little gold objects or child-sized furniture, fascinating materials, the workmanship is incredible. They go on a goodwill tour in the 1960s to America. Some of the museum curators that are going to host it in America, they think, oh, everybody's forgotten them. You know, just do a modest, small scale, no problem. There are queues around the block. It hits this kind of 1960s hopeful, you know, world. It's a troubled world. It's the Cold War, but maybe there's something bigger that connects us. And so Tutankhamun spends the 1960s up to 1981 touring the world as an ambassador for Egypt.
Imagine that one, the Tutankhamun world tour. Imagine being a roadie on that one.
The never-ending tour, as it turned out to be.
But it's an interesting one, isn't it, with the politics. You think about, and you said, because in the 1950s, Egypt becomes independent, a bitter struggle with the UK, with Britain. Nasser takes control. I mean, was he able to say, because he could have just said Tutankhamun represents everything that is colonial, if you like, or is it, this is our heritage, this is our Egypt. You know, the Western powers have nothing to do with this. This is an Egypt that, you know, this is, we are descended from this line of kings, basically.
Absolutely. That's a very powerful feeling in Egypt that this is their heritage. And they had made a point. So there'd been the Egyptian government, Howard Carter, had a huge falling out in the 1920s because Egypt asserted its right, its legal right to keep the objects in the country. Whereas Carter was old school and he thought he'd be able to keep some of them. He'd promised some things to the British Museum. He'd promised some things to the Metropolitan Museum in New York. He'd probably pocketed a few small items, right, which would gradually made their way back.
It's a scarab or two, you know.
So it was a clash of worldviews, exactly. Little beads, little amulets and things. So it is absolutely a source of pride for Egyptians in their heritage and was seen as an opportunity to share that with the world.
I'm just so glad you mentioned the British Museum there because, you know, just a few, because everything sort of, if you, you know, the greatest kleptomaniac stash in the history of the world, you could argue. Let's not go there, huh?
Well, there's different, they're complicated histories. It shows us that all these artifacts and works of art, and you know, they've all got complicated histories and what they signify changes at different times. And I think that's an interesting story.
Talking of changes at different times, the relationship that it has, you're looking at something from over 3,000 years ago, and most things that we come into contact with in 21st century universe aren't over 200 years old. I mean, in the States, you see a 200-year-old building, it's like, wow, that goes real back. And when you see something from then, and, you know, as I said, my best friend is Coptic Egyptian, and he talked, and we had lunch last week, he came over, and he talked about, you know, seeing we're talking about the pyramids and various theories on that, and seeing the light and come up in the hole, and it really puts you back there then, you know, in a different place, obviously. What's it like? Because obviously you have traveled, you have been to the places themselves, and what is the experience of coming face to face with something like this from so far away, and that, you know, that communication or that contact that you have with something so ancient and so mysterious?
It's a privilege. I used to be a museum curator, and there's something about objects that maybe are completely humble looking. They wouldn't be the star objects in a museum display the way that, say, the gold mask is. But things like linen, I mean, I've seen King Tut's, you know, face-to-face, you know, 6 inches away from King Tut's underwear, yeah? And that may sound a bit much, especially, sorry, if you're
3,000-year-old underwear on a Thursday morning, yes.
You know, the weaving of the linen, and to think that all of this craftsmanship was done by hand and that it still survived. So I think it does give us a sense of that sense of connection and humanity. And then the material, like the mask and the materials involved in it and the incredible workmanship that they had with the most basic sort of, you know, technologies in some ways. But the work using molten glass, beating the gold, the cutting the stones to such precise sizes to inlay them, it's just astonishing. It takes your breath away. And it is, I think we have something precious that connects us in the world. And Tutankhamun's tomb goods remind us of that.
So the book, it's an interesting, because you could have just done, you know, a sort of a chronological timeline. This happened, that happened, 1922. Colonialist stumbles through the front door, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But you decided not to do it in that way. And I'm very glad that you didn't. So you've taken this quote unquote holistic approach and how it shapes a century. And I'm looking forward to reading about the Jazz Age immensely. So why did you, I mean, okay, we're coming up to the centenary. So are we going to get deluged then under a Tutankhamun tsunami, do you think?
I think there might be. Watch out in the autumn. You might, I don't know if there's any place you can escape. there will be a lot. And I worry that it's going to tell the same old things. And I think that's not good for us. I think for our society today, our world today, we do need to take a look at bigger pictures and understand it's not about guilt or innocence. It's about all of us being involved some way in these histories that we're not responsible for, but they continue to shape our lives and our politics and our stories. So I wanted to to show that. And I talk about my own career in there, both to bring, give people some sense of what it's like to work on this stuff. Like you say, what it's, what, what's it like to be, you know, nose to nose, as it were, with Tutankhamun. But also to show how it's shaped my life in a very privileged way. Mm. And you have in Egypt today, a fantastic country, you know, 100 million strong population, but a country that still struggles under the weight of poverty, of its own politics, which I'm not someone who's going to comment on that, but you can read the news.
Yeah.
And the changes, the inequalities that persist. And Tutankhamun in some ways is a bridge, but he maybe has helped some people more than others.
I mean, is there a... Have you found in putting this book together, Treasured, that, you know, seeing... that light, you know, seeing that life coming face to face with 3,000 years of history makes people, or should make people, pause and maybe reconsider their place in the universe and the world and what it all means?
I think at the moment it doesn't, because the way it keeps being presented is as if it's as if it's just spectacle. Mm. And I think actually we don't give, you know, museum visitors and readers enough credit, and TV watchers, we don't give people enough credit for being able to understand actually that there's more to the history than that, and that's a richer story.
The book is called Treasured, How Tutankhamun Shaped a Century. I just had a horrible thought. Tutankhamun in the age of 21st century media, are we going to have Tutankhamun TikTok? Wouldn't that just be the worst? You can see it now. I won't play the bangles as well, don't worry. The book is called Treasured, How Tutankhamun Shaped a Century. It's by Christina Riggs, who we've been speaking to today. Christina, if people want to find you online, I know you have a Twitter feed.
I do have a Twitter feed, and you get little bits and bobs about Tutankhamun, as well as pictures of my sheep here in County Durham. So it's kind of a bit of everything.
You didn't tell me about the sheep.
I do. I have a beautiful sheep named Bella.
Okay. Well, she's staying warm. I mean, from County Durham to Cairo, a natural progression.
There you go. You never know where these things are going to take you.
The book is called Treasured, How Tutankhamun Shaped a Century. It's by Christina Riggs, who you'll be speaking to. It is available as a download on the TRE virtual bookstore. Christina, it has been an absolute pleasure to speak to you this morning.
My pleasure too, Jazz. Thank you very much.